Blog Talk Radio.
Hello. Can you hear me now? I think we had some technical difficulties there. And it sounds like maybe perhaps we are now on the air. Blog Talk Radio is amazing to me sometimes with the technical difficulties that go on with the show. But that's okay. We keep working on it. We keep hoping that everything gets better. Good morning, everybody. Good morning. Bobby Rodrigo here. I take liberty with my coffee. May 1st, glad to be back. I was out and about the last couple of weeks. I was in D.C. and L.A. I actually appeared on your Dr. 420 in Los Angeles. That was pretty great with Janani. Been at a few conferences and just a little bit tired on Sunday morning. But glad to be back. Got a great show with you today. Of course, you know we have the Unity Cypher coming down, the torch, coming down from Maine to Florida. It was in Georgia the last few days, and we had some special people here in town. And, of course, the activism in Georgia is pretty special a lot of the time. It's certainly special all of the time when it comes to fighting prohibition, without a doubt. You know, Peachtree Normal and Georgia Care, James Bell, Sharon Revert, and others, the list is long. And then the outside activism, the people who work coalition-wise, EdMeds, and others, Turning Catherine Bernard. There's just a lot of great people in this area when it comes to activism and working to get the legislative branch of the state of Georgia to, I don't know, get their heads out of their butts and do the right thing, of course. So it's important what goes on here, and of course, great people being a part of it, and we have some guests come into Georgia. I'm based in Georgia, for those who don't know. And Radical Russ is going to be joining us this morning, which is fantastic. So I want to get some current affairs out of the way. As you know, we like to go over some things. Of course, you know, since I was on last, Prince died. That was a major, major event, of course. Fantastic, transcendent musician, philanthropist, etc. Matter of fact, I just reported, along with some other organizations, other media outlets, rather, that he was just, one of the things that we're learning about him is that he was paying for solar panels and education in the San Francisco area for lower-income people who have solar panels on their houses, and they didn't know where it was coming from. And he would use concerts as a cover for him to go check on his charities, which I thought was kind of cool. So, of course, you know, we have wonderful is the wrong word. We have the government at work, right? Okay, so for those who understands civics and know how politics works and understands the structure of this country constitutionally, we all know that the Speaker of the House is third in line for the presidency. You know, if something happens, right? Something happens, the president, vice president is next. And if something happens to the vice president, the Speaker of the House is next. So I say this, of course, because there was a man who was the Speaker of the House fairly recently, you know, by the name of Hastert. Hastert. You remember him? Republican Speaker of the House. Well, actually, what I really want to call him is Coach Hastert, because so much of what has been going on with him happened when he was a coach in sports years before. Well, Speaker Hastert just was sentenced to 15 months in prison by the United States District Court Judge Thomas Durkin. Now, old Dennis, you know, old Speaker Dennis, you know, he was involved in money shenanigans, you know, and he was caught doing it. But what was important about that was that he was using his money shenanigans and his bribery payoffs, or the improper payoffs. I don't, bribery is the wrong word, but improper payoff, because he was hiding the fact that he was a serial child molester in his life, in his former life before being on the Hill and being Speaker of the House. That's right, a serial child molester, which is exactly what the United States District Court Judge Thomas Durkin called him, was a serial child molester. You know, and unfortunately, you know, that he wasn't being sentenced for being a serial child molester. But of course, 15 months for an individual like that certainly doesn't seem right, especially considering, you know, today's show is about prohibition and cannabis, et cetera, and we know how many people are serving all these long sentences for possessing cannabis, for example. So, you know, once again, where's the balance? But this is this evil man. So apparently, as this thing has been coming known to the world, more people are coming out. Initially, they had the people who were victims were being kept secret. You know, they don't want their lives thrown upside down. Well, what has happened is because a number of people in Congress have come out in favor of Dennis Hastert. And matter of fact, one of the things the judge did in this particular case that I thought was really, really interesting was he refused to consider any letters in support of Dennis Hastert as far as a sentencing issue unless they were made public. So there was a number of letters that came in that they didn't want made public because they were all coming from people who work in Congress. And when they were told that they didn't want these letters to become public, the judge says, well, I won't consider them, because, of course, this was a matter of, you know, we're talking about a public hearing, you know, criminal court, you know, state district court. So I thought that was interesting. I obviously agree with it. It would have been nice to get the list of people who actually wrote those letters, you know, so we could continue to expose them. But this man was a serial rapist, child molester, which is worse. It's amazing that there can be something worse than a rapist, a serial rapist. The serial child molester would be worse, I guess, when you're talking about levels of evil. So, yeah, so there was $3 million of hush money and all kinds of shenanigans going on. The FBI caught him, and it was based upon him trying to cover up the fact that he was a child molester. Just nasty stuff. And, of course, the probably the worst part of that story is that he was the Speaker of the House, number three in line to run this country. We've lost our minds as a society. Our apathy of allowing these kind of people to be running our country is out of control. We continue to do it. We just follow along and look at what we have. I mean, Speaker of the House is a serial child molester. I mean, I don't even know where to go with that. Positive news. State of Nebraska just abolished civil forfeiture without a criminal conviction. Now, that's two states in the last few weeks. Florida had just done it. And that is a total of 10 in the country now. I know the New Mexico, I just recently did it, et cetera. But there's a total of 10 now that have abolished civil asset forfeiture. And for those who understand what that is, they are just taking money and property, personal and or real, at the whim of law enforcement on no criminal conviction based upon, well, I think this money might be drug money. You know, it's interesting. I think about it a lot because a lot of the times I'll carry a little bit of money on me because of the fact that I need petty cash because I might have 7-8 people working with me in an area and I want to have it. And I'm going to the airport and I'm thinking, I'm just waiting for somebody to say something about the amount of money that I might have on me and take it on the basis of they just want to say, well, that's a lot of money to have on you in cash. We think something's wrong. We're going to take it. And then you have to fight to get it back. So understand the due process, the lack of due process here. You know, and it's like that with property anyway. So we think that this is money that's being used for illicit gains or illicit activity. No proof of it whatsoever. No criminal charges of it whatsoever, and they still get to take the money. The feds still do it. 10 states, nice to see Nebraska did that. I was very happy to see that. Another story that caught my attention that I thought was kind of cool, half not cool, is a gentleman, a North Carolina judge, Lou Oliveira, the name is, sentenced a defendant named Joseph Serna to 24 hours in jail for a probation violation. So we're not talking about, you know, a long time, but still, you know, anyway. So he sentenced the gentleman to 24 hours in jail for a probation violation. And apparently, when he was being sentenced, the judge noticed that the gentleman was shaking when he was turning himself in because he came to court willingly and stuff, and he was shaking. And in the, apparently it was known that he had PTSD. And this is a veterans court that the judge presides over in Cumberland County. So the judge decided to serve the sentence with the gentleman and sit in the cell and speak with him so he wouldn't be alone. Now, that's pretty cool, you know, and of course, having concern, you know, PTSD is a big deal. Again, I mentioned PTSD. I wanted to talk about this a little bit because, again, it ties to the show because we're talking about cannabis today. And that is one of the ways to take care of PTSD we have learned over time, of course, over a length of time. It's kind of been well known for a very long time. But for the judge to do that, you know, it shows that we have a human being for a judge. And considering all the judges out there that aren't human beings, in my opinion, you know, I want to shine a light on one that is. It was kind of cool, and you know, we'd like to see more about it. Morelands. Now, for those of us who pay attention to what goes on in the criminal justice system, and actually in jails and in prisons as well, and I know that my friends at the Human Solution International have a great prison outreach program that they do. So, for those of us who are involved in that, the New Orleans situation is amazing. So the Public Defender's Office has refused to take any cases that are serious, murders or rapes. They refuse because of lack of funding. So I was either the 7th or 8th of this month, the judge in New Orleans decided to release a number of inmates because they have been held for a long, long time, either without representation, without indictment, or without a trial, and there's no money to hire attorneys or the public defender's office will not defend them, so he decided to release them. New Orleans is in complete chaos. when it comes to the criminal justice system, as bad as any place in the country. Easily as bad as any place in the country. So, think about this for a minute. Now, we're talking about people who have been charged with murder, rape, robbery. And the one gentleman that was released has been sitting in jail for 3 years. You know, it's 90 days. Well, I can't tell you off the top of my head what it is in Louisiana. But there is a speedy trial rule everywhere. And, that, you know, some states it's 60, some states it's 90, some states it's longer. Depends on what the particular constitution of that state says in relation to that. But there is a speedy trial rule. There's also the federal thing. And a lot of times what happens is, you know, these guys who get public defenders and they'll waive their speedy trial rights. And then, of course, that opens the door for them sitting there for a very long time. So this is what has happened in New Orleans, where they're actually releasing these people en masse, or trying to. Now, the judge did give the state 10 days to appeal his ruling. So actually, it happened on March 5th. And I was actually looking to see if there was any follow-up on that, but I didn't see any as of yet. I'm going to make some calls later on in the week to see what's going on. But, yeah, so, you know, one gentleman, Henry Campbell, was arrested and booked into local jail on first-degree rape charge. So we're talking, he was arrested in March 5th, 2013. You know, do the math. 3 years in jail waiting to be tried is certainly not constitutional. So there's a mess going on there. Now the public defender's office in New Orleans is saying that they hope that they get sued. They want to get sued. Because they want this, the more advocacy that's out there against them, the more press it's going to happen on the case, et cetera, et cetera. So that's really cool that the exposure is happening so justice, of course, can be done properly. And, of course, that there is money that is allocated for the public defender's office. And that's something that's going on all over the country, of course. So I'm going to cut it off right there because normally, as you know, I like to do the first half hour of the show on current events and just do some ranting and stuff and then have my guests come on. But today's guest has a little bit of a time crunch, so I want to bring him on a little bit early. So, as you know, we did a show recently about the Unity Cipher, which is essentially a comparison to the Olympic torch. You know, and of course, we're familiar with that in Atlanta, having the Olympics had been here in Atlanta, for example, where I am headquartered at. But it was a my child of one of the members of the Maryland Normal, and we had him on the show along with Sharon Revert from Peachtree Normal to talk about, like we always do, Prohibition and what the Unity Cipher was about. So what was interesting about it when it reached Georgia, because it just reached Georgia a couple of days ago, was the amount of passion and also some of the guests that came from elsewhere to support the particular transportation of the torch. And I happened to notice that Russ Bellevue was here, Radical Russ, one of the great radio personalities out there fighting against Prohibition. So Ted Metz, a mutual friend of ours, who recently a candidate for the Libertarian Party for the United States Senate, and you know, we had him on our show as well. Good friend of mine, worked with him a lot. Reached out to me, let me know that Russ might be available, and I asked, and he's here, and I want to bring him on right now. So, hey, good morning, Russ. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing fine. Thanks for having me on.
Certainly, certainly. Radical Russ. So, the radical one. You got to tell me what brings you to Georgia. Talk to me about what brings you to Georgia.
Well, I'm embarked on what I call my Legalize America Tour, 50 states by age 50. So I'm now up to, I just did South Carolina and Georgia, and I'm headed to Florida, and that'll be 24 states that I've made. I've got another, 20 months to get the other 26.
Well, that's a rather aggressive schedule you have there, young man. That'll be nice to see. And obviously, you're broadcasting while you're doing this, of course, because you're on the air a lot.
Right. I'm the host of the Russ Bellevue Show on CannabisRadio.com, and I do a live daily two-hour talk radio show on marijuana legalization that I like to call the NPR of POT.
Fantastic. Yes, of course, all of us that are against prohibition are very aware of you. At least I hope everybody is. I know I have been. Certainly everybody make sure and pay attention to what Russ is doing, because he is one of the leading voices out there against prohibition, absolutely. So tell me, Russ, how did you – what got your attention? You know, go back some years. I mean, you've been doing this a while. So go back some years, and how did you get started? What brought your attention to the prohibition issue and the marijuana absurdity that we have in our society?
Sure. Well, I grew up in Idaho, where we have two strains of marijuana, got some and don't. And so I started smoking pot. I was in a rock and roll band, met some guitar players, and started smoking pot around 1990. But it was never really like a political thing. It was just, it's illegal, you've got to hide it, and that's the way it is. But in 2003, I moved to Oregon, and out in Oregon, it's a lot more political. And, there was actually a shot in hell that we could change marijuana prohibition. In Idaho, it's not even a concern. And, it's just, it's illegal. That's the way it's always going to be. But once I got to Oregon, I started meeting people that were politically involved in this activism. I got to meet Jack Herer and Paul Stanford and, a bunch of
sure.
great activists. It kind of, opened my eyes to, wait a minute, this is a political issue. It's not just, it's a dangerous drug, we got to ban it, or, whatever. It's that it's wrong. And there's no logical reason to have it banned. So in 2005, I got involved in my first global cannabis march on May 7th, 2005. And then this May 7th, I'll be in Fort Worth, Texas to celebrate my 11th anniversary in marijuana activism.
That's fantastic. It's amazing how things get our attention. And, of course, Oregon, where the medical side of the marijuana issue has been so prominent for so many years, as well as the state of Washington. I'm sure you noticed that, obviously, being up in the Pacific Northwest. And in your education of marijuana, how much of that got you motivated on the basis of the medical side of cannabis?
I would say it's really what flipped the switch for me, that put the motivation for me to get involved politically. As I was coming up in Idaho and I was in a band, I was never at a lack for weed. So like there was no pressure on me, right? I was always going to be able to find weed. I was never going to get caught. I'm a middle-aged white guy. Nobody's going to give me any trouble. I never worried about it. But I got married. And, I'm divorced now, but I had gotten married at the time, and my wife at the time suffered from migraine headaches and endometriosis, which is like menstrual
sure.
cramps on steroids, right? So
sure.
She had tried all these, medications and hospital trials, and nothing really worked well for her, and she wasn't a pot smoker. And I said, one day I said, look, try it. Try smoke. She had a migraine coming on. I'm like, just try it. And it was a miracle how much that worked for her. It was like, when you watch the cartoons and they hit the cartoon character on the toe with a hammer and he turns red like a thermometer and it just bursts through his head? Like, if you could
sure.
run that in reverse, if you could back that up and run it in reverse, that's what it was like when my ex-wife took her first hit of cannabis for a migraine. Like, you could just see the pain melt off her face. And it was at that moment that I kind of became political about it, because it was like, I know how to be a stoner in Idaho and not get caught, but she doesn't. And she's going to get me busted
sure.
if we stay here in Idaho. So it was that was the catalyst that made me decide we needed to move to Oregon so that, she could get on the medical marijuana program and we could be protected.
Amazing how that works. And, it's interesting because migraines are one of the great evils of the world. People who suffer
yeah.
from migraines, it puts them down.
They'll joke about it. Some of our opponents, will joke about medical marijuana. They say, you can say you have a headache and get a card, right? They've never seen what a migraine headache can do to someone. I've been with my ex-wife at times where, she would, if she'd had a pistol, she'd have shot herself rather than suffer
sure.
the pain she would
yeah.
show. It's intense.
Yeah, there's actually a friend of mine. Last time I was in Mexico, he's a friend of mine who lives outside of Guadalajara, and he suffers greatly from migraine headaches, and he takes a bandana and ties it on his head. It looks like he's going to, it's like a tourniquet. It's so tight. And when he gets an attack, if we're driving in the car, he takes the most direct route to the doctor's office, whether he's driving the wrong way on streets or something, because I decided to go to sleep in the back of the vehicle when he was doing it, because I'm like, I'm done watching this. And he's driving the wrong way, 40 miles an hour up down the street, to get to the doctor's office so he can get a shot, so he can get the relief. Yeah. I mean, it's crazy what it does, absolutely. You know, when I talk about the medicinal, or when I have the medicinal argument with people, like, you know, I make it simple. My approach is, everybody knows that cannabis relieves the nauseousness from chemotherapy. It's pretty much common knowledge, it has been forever. It's not like that's new. Even people who hate drugs and hate marijuana know that that's the truth. So that means that cannabis has the medical equivalency of rolling or oxycodone, which means it has a medicinal property, which means it's getting sold over the counter for nauseousness. You know, and just break it down and, you know, make it obvious so people can relate to it a little bit better is one of the ways that I approach it. But it is very frustrating when you hear people argue against, like our DEA chief, who says, you know, it's a joke to think that cannabis has any medicinal value. And yet the United States government has two patents, you know, for medical cannabis. Please explain that.
Yeah, the disconnect that happens on that comes from framing. And the framing that I'm talking about, when we talk about framing, it's the concepts that surround what we're talking about. Like, if I say elephant, it's not just an elephant. It's a lot of concepts. You might think of Republicans or Africa or memory or circus, which aren't technically anything, you know, they're not elephant, but they have a lot to do with elephant, or they conjure, you know, in your mind when you think of elephants. Well, to the mainstream, when we use the frame medical, that conjures into their heads doctors and white coats and pill bottles and prescriptions and very precise dosages. And so that's when those people are saying, you know, marijuana is not medical, what they're really saying is a crude plant matter that's inconsistent does not meet our definition of what a precise medicine is. And to that extent, they're right in a technical sense, right? It's like if I'm saying that a motorcycle is not a car. Right, a motorcycle is not a car because it has two wheels rather than four. But both of them will get you where the hell you want to go. And that's what I like to say with medical marijuana, right? It's not a medicine in the sense of it's a pill that we always know exactly what's in it. It has a precise dose, and it always works the same way for everybody, like a Rolaids would. But that doesn't mean it doesn't get you where you want to go. It doesn't mean that using this medicinal herb – can't be beneficial, and obviously it is for so many people in so many ways. It's really a question of us trying to put a square peg in a round hole in their understanding, and all we got to do is change that hole in their understanding.
You know, it's an interesting way to look at it, without a doubt. I'm in full agreement with you, and it falls in so many other areas look at our politics today. You know, the associative nature of what we're seeing is that's a very good example, absolutely. And hopefully people will give you a chance to show them exactly how that works. Unfortunately, when it comes to perception, you know, starting with, well, even before Nixon, but starting with Nixon, you know, the nature of the game was directed at destroying parts of our society. So you have that going on as well. You know, it's you're dealing with people who, we don't believe that it's this, or, you know, or the FDA isn't coming out and saying anything. But you also had directional, you know, evil, you know, coming out of the Nixon administration, wanted to destroy the, you know, the minority society and the hippies and stuff like that. And then, of course, the prison industrial complex. So we're dealing with a lot of things trying to get this stopped.
Right. And you know, I'm glad you brought that up in that Harper's Magazine piece that really, you know, illustrated that what we already knew was true, which was that the Nixon's war on drugs was conjured to undermine black power and leftist power movements in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I feel medical marijuana falls short, because medical marijuana in its as a policy, what medical marijuana says is that marijuana is still a terribly dangerous thing, but if you can find someone to give you a permission slip for it, we'll look the other way. But that doesn't go far enough as far as undermining the government's ability to still use that prohibition to undermine those parts of society they don't want to see have power. And that's when I started, you know, over the past five years or so, as I've seen medical marijuana develop, because what's happened is, you know, you'll see that map all the time where they'll paint in all the states that have medical, and it looks so wonderful, right? But then you realize that, no, the states that got medical in the 90s and the early 2000s out west, their medical marijuana is nothing like New York, Minnesota, or now Pennsylvania, right? You have the first wave of medical marijuana where you could plant your own plant, grow your own medicine, use it yourself. Everybody was cool with it. Then the next wave that came was, okay, you can buy your medicine at a dispensary, but you can't grow it yourself at home. And now the latest wave is you can buy stuff from a dispensary, but it's not going to be a plant that you can smoke. It's going to be in a bottle. It's going to be a pill. It's going to be a, you know, what they got in New York and Minnesota and now Pennsylvania, this non-smokable medical marijuana. So really there's like three different types of medical marijuana states. You can't compare California and Oregon to Pennsylvania and Minnesota. They're not even in the same ballpark. And so that's where I've come to realize that I've called it for a long time that medical marijuana is a box canyon politically. It leads us to GW pharmaceuticals. It leads us to prescriptions. It leads us to carefully calibrated doses, and it leads us away from the plant. It, with medical marijuana, we give into the other side's idea of what medical is, and they're going to want to put it into those bottles. And they're going to want to put it into those prescriptions. I say the fight now is for full-on legalization, and instead of saying all use is medical, it's all use is none ya. It's none ya damn business why I'm using it.
Sure.
If we live in a society that's recognized that adults can use alcohol and tobacco, then there is absolutely no logical reason to prevent them from using a substance that's far safer than either two of those.
No, and there never has been, obviously. And you make the point of the fact that it's safer. I mean, the safety of it is the point, you know, for me, without question, when you compare it to the alcohol and tobacco situation. And then, of course, the lack of side effects. And you're right. The medicinal, you know, of course, the medicinal access for people who need it for those purposes is of paramount importance. But you're right.
Yeah.
The problem is it needs to be nunya, without question. I love it. When you're dealing with a situation where you're dealing with adult people having the choices that they want to make, and what's the problem, people? Well, the problem is that we would certainly be letting all these people out of jail, not having these people get arrested. All that money gets lost. You know, that targeting gets lost. You know, it's almost like the generations just need to die so we can move on with new thinking because, geez. And then, you know, and I'm sure you have a position on this. I have to believe you do. Then you add the aspect of industrial hemp to the discussion, and
it just
continues to get more absurd that we don't have. We don't have. I mean, what is going on here?
Yeah, banning industrial hemp because it looks like marijuana is like banning powdered sugar because it looks like cocaine. There's just no logic to it.
Exactly.
You've got the Drug Enforcement Administration enforcing a ban on something that is not a drug. There's just no logic to it whatsoever. And going back to the medical for just a second, one thing about setting up a medical marijuana law is that you are specifically drawing a line. And you're drawing a line that says on this side of the line, you don't get busted for weed, but on the other side of the line, you're still a criminal and you get busted for weed. And no matter where you draw that line, someone who's a patient's going to be on the criminal side, and someone who's a criminal is going to find his way onto the patient side. Absolutely. And this can happen, you know, in a place like California where anybody can get a recommendation, but yet some people still can't get medical marijuana because of local bans. It can happen in places that have medical marijuana, but they don't have your particular ailment, right? Like if you're a patient in, say, Michigan, you might not be able to get it for PTSD. Or if you're someone with a particular stomach disease, you might not get it in Delaware or whatever, right? There's no consistency.
Right.
And then and then no matter how you set up your medical marijuana program, an enterprising stoner is going to find his way to get onto that program, no matter what. So let's dispense with all the pretense. Let's stop pretending that we can keep stoners out of medical or that we can have a perfect program that covers all patients and actually do that. Just make it legal for everyone, and then no patient is left out and no stoner has to break any rules.
Absolutely. And then add to that the economic benefits of industrial hemp, which is really not even, you know, it's amazing that we're even talking about the two together for me. You know, like you mentioned, you know, the DEA is enforcing something that's not even a drug, you know, and of course, like you mentioned, they said because it looks like it. Yeah, because they actually came out and said, well, we can't tell the difference, so we're going to have to do that, which is, it's amazing some of the things that comes out of our government's mouth. But of course, hemp, the industrial hemp side of it, you have, you know, DuPont involved, and of course you have the fuel industries involved and all these others. But the upside of what happens to our economy with hemp as well is amazing. It's solving so many problems, and here we are. Well, we're not going to have anything legal. It's mind-boggling to me. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm really excited about, you know, the industrial hemp applications. One of them that's exciting to me is the building material hempcrete, which I've had the opportunity to actually put together some hempcrete blocks in a demonstration. And, I mean, everything you want out of a building material, cheap, recyclable, breathable, carbon negative, fireproof, mildew-proof, rot-proof. I mean, it's just an amazing thing. And then the other thing that's and I think this next development is the killer app as far as hemp goes. This is the one that's going to break hemp out of the box, and that is – one of the problems we've got with renewable energy technologies like solar and wind and tidal and all of these natural sort of power options is that we have a power grid that depends on a constant flow of power. And the problem with sun and wind is it ain't always windy and it's not always sunny, right? So when you have these alternative sources, you have to have batteries to store when it's, you know, when it's really sunny, you can store up some power. And then when it's dark, you can use some of that battery power and keep that constant flow. Well, the problem with that is that making these batteries requires a carbon product called graphene. Now, graphene is pretty expensive, and it's made it to the point where it's not yet cost effective to do a lot of solar and wind because you got to buy all this battery power, you know, all this battery backup, and those batteries are expensive. Well, just last year, some scientists working with industrial hemp discovered that the bast fibers of the hemp plant could be made into battery components that would replace these graphene components at 1/1,000th of the cost. So we are talking about the possibility of hemp being able to create the battery technology that we've been needing to unlock solar and wind and tidal and all these alternative energies. And I think that is where hemp starts to really take off. Once people recognize that, once that technology is developed, the ability to create cheap and renewable and economically friendly power through hemp is really what's going to make this take off.
Well, I certainly hope so. You know, I unfortunately have a skepticism because hemp has been put aside so for so many years by the big industries as much as anybody.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, anything that breaks that down, I'm in favor of and in favor of supporting without question. And that is a marvelous advance that you're just talking about. It wouldn't surprise me, of course, that it starts getting used in other countries where we're sitting here going, okay, like they're building hemp cars in Canada, which, of course, we did here, Henry Ford did here as well, but we're building hemp cars in Canada right now, and, you know, we're sitting here in the United States looking at it going, really? You know, and actually, you can go buy that car and bring it here. You know, just like we can buy a product that can't be grown
right.
here.
It's,
you know, we're supporting it. What is that about? It's amazing. You know, you have, and this again goes back to Nunya, of course, because if you just approach it that way, all of these walls fall down out of the way.
Yeah.
You know, total agreement there. So you, part of what you've been doing, from what I understand, and this is the first time you and I have ever talked, what you've been doing over the years, from what I understand, is you've been a writer for High Times magazine, which, of course, was at the forefront of this. I've been involved in cannabis for 30 years, and High Times was the one that was leading the charge on this year's
yeah.
show. So talk about your history with High Times.
Yeah, well, I was fortunate enough to meet the late Michael Kennedy, who was the lawyer and the kind of the man who was running High Times for so long. He just passed away last year. And I've been friends
right.
with a lot of the folks that work at High Times, like Danny Danko and Bobby Black. He's not there anymore, but Dan Sky and so forth. I think I wrote my first article for High Times probably around 2008 or 2009. I've got my latest article, and I think it may be my – I don't know, 18th or 19th in the print magazine, that it's in this most recent edition, the June 2016 edition, where my writing is mostly appears on the High Times website, hightimes.com, where every Tuesday and Friday I have a column called Radical Rant. And I just published my 400th column on the Radical Rant for High Times. So, yeah, they've been great to me. I've covered every High Times Cannabis Cup except the first one in Detroit and the most recent ones in San Bernardino, because I've been on the road in the South. But other than that, I've done every Cannabis Cup in the United States. I was there at the first one in San Francisco in 2010.
That's fantastic. And you know, you mentioned some people. Michael Kennedy was a beacon for a long, long time. Phenomenal lawyer, great reputation.
Oh, yeah.
without a doubt.
Yeah, the guy defended Manuel Noriega when the U.S. extradited him from Panama. I mean, that's how high-level a guy this was. You know, world-class attorney, but yet had such a love and passion for defending High Times. It was a great relationship.
Yeah, really. And High Times, of course, you know, I had the good fortune of growing up in New York, and so High Times wasn't hidden from our magazine racks, you know, when I was growing up, like it has been in other places. So I've been a reader of it for a very long time, and they really got it. You know, it's interesting that the message has been the same the entire time, and their fight has been the same the entire time. And, of course, it goes to, when you look at the history, for example, when people were still challenging, the fact that marijuana is a Schedule I drug, and how the courts wouldn't even let the argument happen in front
right.
of them. You couldn't even, you know, they wouldn't even allow it to happen. High Times has been right. trying to get that for decades.
Yeah. It's funny how, you know, a lot of people, you know, will bring up points like, well, the government has these patents on medicine, and there's 24 states that say it's medicine. How can they say it's not medical? Well, it's interesting because the way the Controlled Substances Act is written, and really this is if you look at it from the perspective of an evil genius, it's perfect. The Controlled Substances Act was a work of evil genius, because the way it's written is that the DEA doesn't have to make sense in the real world. It only has to make sense based on its own rules. So if the
right.
DEA makes a rule that says our reasons that something is medical is X, Y, and Z, and then they follow X, Y, and Z, then they're right, because the rule says if the DEA follows their own rules, they're right. And they get to make
right.
up their own rules.
it is amazing. It is amazing. And, you know, for what, if people don't who are new to this movement, for example, what they need to realize is the history of this movement is important, because I was mentioning the court cases. So when cannabis has been challenged to Schedule I, actually the very first time that they were allowed to even present the case on the merits, get it through the door, was, I believe, about 3 years ago. It was the first time where they actually were able to do that. The Federal Circuit, which deals with this, wouldn't even let you get the case on the docket. They refused
yeah.
to let the case go to be heard where you could actually go make an argument. They didn't even let you do the argument, which is amazing considering that petitioning the government for redress of grievances, which is what that is a protected right in this country, mm-hmm. and yet it still wasn't allowed. And it's just amazing. And High Times would report about this. I would read about this. I'm just like, you got to be kidding. You can't even get the court. It's like, so you talk about it having to knock down some walls, because of course, years ago there was, you know, and I know Sharon Revert, who you've met, if you didn't know before, who you've met this week, you know, one of the things she talks about a lot is how we all thought that the prohibition was going to end in the 70s. And, you know, there was all this momentum and stuff, and then poof, it's gone. You know, I remember all of that, of course, and was involved in it to a degree. My basic involvement really started, I knew about it because I was a teenager, but when the 80s rolled around, that's when I got really heavily involved. And I remember reading about all of the fighting that was being done in High Times, and it was like banging your head against the wall. Mm-hmm. No matter what legal arguments that you did, no matter what intelligent approach that you made, no matter what political lobbying you did, it didn't matter. They didn't want to hear it. It's just amazing.
Right.
So what do you think about today's both movement and where we are going forward? What do you see positive and negative?
Well, I think the positive, of course, is just our momentum that we've got. You know, four states have already legalized, and in those states, when they re-poll the people, they show even more support. So it's not like, you know, they voted for it and then, oh my God, all hell broke loose and we regret what we did. It's just the opposite. They voted for it. Things turned out just fine, and in some cases even better because of the tax revenues. And people went, oh, well, this actually works. So to me, I think, you know, we're a snowball rolling downhill right now. Just because I think it's pretty much inevitable at this point that we get legalization through most of the country. Those are the positives. I would say the negative that's happening is medical marijuana related, in that idea that every medical marijuana law we see coming up just gets more and more and more restrictive as they continue to try to keep the potheads out of the medical side. That's what led to all these CBD oil bills out here in the South. Right. It's like you brought all these epileptic kids onto the state house and the lawmakers, you know, that was too much. They could not ignore that. That's the worst TV image in the world, is to be seen as a lawmaker that hates kids. Right. So they passed these CBD oil bills as kind of a cover your ass. Like, well, OK, you begged for medical. We did something, even though the CBD without the THC doesn't help most of the kids. And even though we're not going to give you a place to get it, you got to go out of state and become a federal drug trafficker to be able to help your sick kid. But at least we did something. And I worry about that, because then a lot of the uninformed people out there, when we come back to them and say, hey, we want to fight for medical marijuana, they're going to go, well, didn't we give you medical marijuana? No, we give you an inch, you want to take a mile, right? And that's where I worry. I think that's the negative, is this continued dilution of medical marijuana and continued restriction of it to try to make it, you know, airtight to keep the stoners out. The more you try to do that, the worse the medical marijuana law gets. It doesn't help the patients, and it doesn't stop the stoners.
And Georgia's a great example of that, as you just brought up. You know, we have in Georgia – we don't have the opportunity to put this on the ballot either. So the only way that anything is going to happen in this state is it has to happen through the legislative process. And you're right. I mean, one of the things that was going on at the end of the legislative process is they wanted to remove some of the gains that were made in order to change the bill. And of course, you know, luckily, the movement is rigid and understands what they're dealing with and doesn't want to give up anything that they've already got. Of course, they want more here. But that is what you just described, is exactly what's going on here in Georgia. And of course, as you know, the cultivation is not allowed here. As you mentioned, you have to break the law in order to get the oil. It's just, it's lunacy. And we elect these people.
it's incredible. And it's the kind of thing where, you know, I did an event in Texas earlier this year, and I got to meet this little 10-year-old girl named Alexis Bortel, and you can find her online under Team Alexis. Anyway, so Alexis is one of these little girls. She suffers from that severe epilepsy, and would have, you know, hundreds of seizures a week, right? She's behind in her development. She's not speaking and reading as well as the other kids. She's getting lousy grades because she's always in the nurse's office. She's always having a seizure, right? So Texas passes this CBD oil bill, right? But they try it for her, and it doesn't work for her very well because it doesn't have enough of that THC. So her dad and her family, they have to pack up and they move to Colorado, where they can actually get some oil that's going to work for her. And what do you know? Now she just passed her 400th day without a seizure. She's getting straight A's in school. Her reading and her vocal skills are above grade level. But she can't go back to Texas because their CBD oil bill doesn't help her. And it's, again, it just goes back to this idea that all use is none ya. If we just relent and let the pothead smoke pot, then everybody else who needs it for the medical purposes can get it too.
Yeah, absolutely. Amazing.
Yeah.
It's stories like that are just, again, mind-boggling. It goes on and on and on. You know, it's interesting. I don't know if you're familiar with Amber Austin Thurman. I wrote an article about what was happening with her because, of course, we have the other issue, another issue of how DCF goes after people who are using cannabis medically or any other way, for that example.
Yeah.
I mean, you know where we're going with that. So,
I have two friends. Oh, I was going to say, sorry to interrupt, but I have two friends from Idaho, both mothers who have had their kids taken away over their medical cannabis use. One's a multiple sclerosis patient. The other one's a Crohn's patient. And both of them had to leave their home state. One moved to Washington, one moved to Oregon. It's disgusting.
It really is. And the thing about, you mentioned epilepsy and stuff, is, you know, here's a woman, of course, who's using it in a state where it's legal. And a state where it's not legal where a child was, that's considered a child. But here's a woman who's using it illegally, who has epilepsy, who because of the proper usage has not had a seizure in 10 years.
Yeah.
So that's the part that's important. You know, once you figure it out, you know, once the right medicine is there, well, it works.
Yeah. And that's what gets so frustrating to all of us. Is it's like, you know, I was just in this Facebook battle with this prohibitionist in Denver, Colorado. Her name's Christine Tatum. And she kept making the point that, you know, anecdotes are not evidence. Just because we have all this anecdotal information about medical marijuana, that's not rigorous scientific proof. And I'm like, I don't care if it's scientific proof or the hand of God. When I see a 10-year-old girl stop seizing for 400 years or 400 days, that's medicine. I don't care how else you want to define it. I can see it with my own damn eyes.
Exactly. Anecdotal, that had to be some hell of a discussion right there.
Yeah.
I was at the Patient Out of Time conference a couple weeks ago in Baltimore.
Yeah.
And it was marvelous to see, and there was a discussion that I actually filmed by a woman here in Georgia named Debbie Word. Actually, they're from Alabama, but now they live in Georgia. And her daughter, an epileptic patient, through the history of the usage and stuff, she was having violent seizures, and, of course, she was using this heavy medications that were giving her violent side effects. She had a miscarriage from a pregnancy, et cetera. Mm. She became pregnant again. Of course, she's trying to have the baby, and she refuses to use those drugs after having two more violent seizures, and she decides to medicate herself with medical cannabis. She doesn't have any more seizures. She has the baby, and the state of Alabama, of course, violates the Fourth Amendment. The hospital does, and does blood testing on her, and does testing on the baby. They find that the baby has THC, and they arrest her and take the child.
Yeah.
So the mother was telling the story because the mother was not pro cannabis use or understood any of this. And the most beautiful part about this story is how the mother was educated and how she now understands that the daughter was doing what's best. Of course, the baby's fine. And luckily, the state of Alabama has decided not to prosecute because she was able to get a good lawyer in there, and she had a prosecutor who, once presented with the situation, understood and decided to do a non-fop. So that's a good story. But it just goes to show that if people would take the time to really see what's going on, that they would be able to see the light, without a doubt.
Yeah. No doubt about it, man. So much of this, I think sometimes our beginning activists, they learn the truth. You know, they read Jack Harrow's Emperor Wears No Clothes. They learn the truth, and they think, if only we exposed everyone to the truth, this would all be changed. And, to some extent. But really, so much of this has little to do with fact, science, reason, and logic, and a whole lot to do with fear, emotion, and racism. And
absolutely,
we have to remember that as you're addressing this, we're addressing things that are irrational and that are built out of, you know, fear and racism. And the way to combat those things is through exposure and, you know, coming out of the closet and letting people recognize they don't have anything to fear from the legalization. And I think that's why I think we're a snowball rolling downhill at this point. Because until Colorado and Washington legalized, the idea of legalization was an abstract. Oh, my God, we might legalize,
right,
and shit might happen. Right? We have no idea what,
right,
but oh my God, something might happen, right? Well, now we've legalized four states,
right,
and shit didn't happen. And so now it's hard to make that argument of, oh my God, scary things are going to happen, because you can look at Colorado and go, well, got it. It seems okay in Colorado.
Yeah, it really does. You know, you have Washington has its problems, as you know. And, you know, Oregon will see. But Colorado has been going very well, fortunately.
Washington State is the beacon. I always like to say that Washington State is the worst legalization of the four states that legalized, and it's 100 times better than the prohibition they used to have. I can go
right.
To
well, I have to agree with that. I mean, first of all, with the Liquor Control Board involved, they're messing it up good, and then of course they've always had a hard time up there with the dispensaries anyway. You know, particularly
with
the state revenue department, et cetera. But it is horrible. Right.
Yeah, a lot of people think that, legalization happened and it destroyed medical. No, medical was kind of messed up in Washington to start with, right? It already had its problems. Its day was coming anyway. But, Washington needs to get home grow, and their legislature's working on that. They need to end that stupid 5-nanogram per se DUID.
Right.
That's obviously a travesty. But by and large, Washington legalization has been a rousing success. 63% of the charges that used to be filed for marijuana are no longer filed. So that's almost 2 out of 3 people who used to get busted for weed don't get busted for weed anymore. And that's not just the less than 1 ounce that got legalized. That's all weed charges. That's all possession, all cultivation, all trafficking, right? So, and it's because when you legalize even a little bit, you just took away the I smell weed excuse. Right now, cops have the I smell weed excuse. Whether they smell it or not, they can make that excuse to start rifling around and trying to find some other reason to bust you. You take away the I smell weed excuse for the cop, you take away the I smell weed excuse for the drug dog as well, and that leads to fewer people getting busted. So that's been a success as far as Washington. And then the other thing that's been a success, even though they initially had, you know, a glut, like a really, you know, tough time getting their supply worked out in Washington State. It's been worked out now. My local pot shop, I'm from Portland, Oregon. I can go across the river to Vancouver, Washington, to a pot shop called Main Street Marijuana, pick up a sun-grown a half ounce of Durban Poison, testing at 24% THC, taxed at 37%, and it cost me $45. $45 a half ounce for top shelf weed. So I think legalization is working just fine.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that at all. I'll be right up.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, that's obviously, that's one of the specials they had going on, 45 a half ounce. But regular prices, 75 to 80 to 90 a half ounce. So we're talking $180 ounces when you work it out at the top level, at the most expensive I can find. It would be almost impossible for me to find an ounce of weed that sells for more than $200 in the Pacific Northwest.
Right. question in the chat room is how many fingers for a full ounce?
A four-finger lid, man. We're going to get a four-finger lid with a draft. That's funny. I was in Las Vegas a little while back doing some consulting with this guy. He's in his 60s, and he kept saying, "Hey, man, you want to smoke some grass?" I'm like, "That's so cute." He still calls it grass. I love it.
Well, you know, some of us are a little older, man. You know, we haven't changed our habits. You know, I'm still trying to figure out what the hell a blunt is. What are you talking about?
What's this dab that people keep talking about?
Yeah, we didn't do that. And a gas mask? God damn. Anyway. the federal government, talk about them for a minute. Now, we know from our activism over the years and years and years, and one of the problems that we're having, of course, is the disregard of the state laws and the way the federal government is pounding. And California got pounded for a very long time, and still does to a degree, but the feds are going to behave the way they're going to behave, even though they're changing some things on paper, the DEA does what the DEA does. Going back to where you see this going, is focusing on the Fed aspect of it, what are you seeing there?
Well, I really think that the states are the ones that are going to keep pushing this for at least the next 4 years, up until 2020. If the feds do anything, it might be rescheduling of cannabis. There's some talk about creating a new type of Schedule 1 subclass called Schedule 1R that would allow for research. You know, the feds are going to go slower than a brontosaurus on this. They're going to just drag their heels as long as they can. But this 2016 election, we've already got Nevada and Maine on the ballot. Massachusetts, Arizona, and California are likely to be on the ballot. And if all five of those states pass, and Michigan's working on it too. So we could have six states on the ballot for legalization. We could have Florida, Ohio, and Missouri on the ballot for medical. If we get six legal states
too.
We get six legal states and four medical states in one election, it's going to be real hard for them to drag their feet much longer.
Yeah, well, that's true. You know, the pressure is as much of a way to do it as much as it is with their reputation, obviously. Certainly they're keeping the pressure up on them as much as possible, without a doubt. With some of the other nonprofit work that I do, we spend a lot of time on the Hill hitting them over the head, you know, and it works to a degree. I actually was talking to one of the lobbyists that I work with, or lobbyists is the wrong word, one of the baseball bat swingers, I guess, that I work with, and I told him, I said, you know, we really need you to get involved in cannabis, so I'm waiting for him to do that. He says he's interested in doing it, and he's been successful in getting legislation passed. It's tiring to see the resistance both on state and federal level when it comes to this and relationship to the way the police come out against it, you know. And
that's going to get better as more and more states become legal and more and more people are out and proud, and there's going to be less and less pressure on these guys to be so against it. But I want to thank you for having me on your show. I'm just pulling up to the Atlanta airport. I'm flying to Miami.
Absolutely.
For my next event, so I have to get off the line here. But thanks so much for having me on your show, and good luck with everything you're doing here in Georgia.
Yeah, no doubt. I appreciate it. Appreciate you stopping by. You know, we appreciate you here in Georgia. Of course, I'm out there national as well with you, and always looking to support other people who are doing it. You're doing great work, and appreciate it. We without a doubt, the movement appreciates it, as you know, and look forward to running into you again out there, and travel well.
All right, man. See you soon.
Take care. Well, that's great having us on. It's great discussion, absolutely. You know, I find it interesting when you're talking to people who have been inside the fight. you know, how much clarity there is, you know, because you're seeing it hand in hand. You know, when we are talking to, I don't know, politicians, to law enforcement, to patients, to people who have been arrested, for people who just want to use, to adults, to ideological discussions, there's a lot of clarity. I mean, I have a lot of clarity. To me, it's very simple what the solutions are here. And I would hope that it would be simple for anyone else that's listening to this, that, you know, bottom line, prohibition is wrong. It has been wrong from the beginning. There's absolutely no reason for it. No one has died in the history of the world from cannabis use. And that is very important. When you look at the picture, when you look at all of this, the big picture of all of this, the fact that cannabis, first you start with the Schedule 1 aspect of it, which makes it the most dangerous category of a drug. And then you look at the sentences that people have for possessing marijuana, even selling it, for example, but the possessing of it, and the fact that it is not physically addicting, and the fact that it has never killed anybody. And what are we doing? Why has this been happening? Why do we have prohibition other than for, I guess you would call it, evil reasons? You know, the revelations about the Nixon administration and Nixon and why he did what he did, you know, it's common knowledge now, or at least if you don't know about it, you should find out about it, because it is common knowledge now on how he was using the cannabis scheduling and law enforcement to attack the minorities and to attack the left, and successfully, considering how many people are in jail for a plant. It is really ridiculous that we've had this situation as long as we've had. And it's unfortunate. And so many lives have been touched negatively by prohibition. It is beyond amazing. So it was actually refreshing to talk to somebody who has a lot of clarity as well, who's been in a fight, who's obviously spending the majority of his time in the fight, which is fantastic to see. Activists like that and professionals like that are hard to come by. And you know, add him to the list of people that should be respected in the fight, and put him in the group of all the people that we know that are doing it, which is fantastic. So I want to get back to some of the subjects we were talking about, and I'll stay on point here. I know, you know, when you talk about, and I was actually reading a cannabis story that I ran across, about 2 weeks ago. Let me see if I can find it again here. Let's see. So you have, so did you guys, speaking of absurdity, did you see the story about the gentleman who's accused of stealing $31 worth of candy and how he's facing life? He was charged that way, and he's facing life. Actually, even the judge said, isn't that a little bit over the top? And considering, you know, that, well, he's had these convictions before, and the convictions that he's had has never amounted to anything more than up to $450 worth of shoplifting, essentially. And yet the prosecutor decided to put him out there for life. It is ridiculous. So the DEA we were talking about earlier, and I don't know if you happen to see, but the DEA was busted again for dealing drugs, and I'll just read this to you. Former deputy with the Tangipahoa Parish Sheriff's Office, Johnny Domingue, pled guilty last Friday, March 11th, so this has been about a month, to three drug conspiracy charges and one count of abuse of office. Domingue took a plea deal and is now rolling over on his co-conspirators, according to the Free Thought Project. Also implicated are Deputy Carl Newman, who has faced similar charges. Domingue was caught using his authority as a DEA officer to rob suspects of cash and drugs, and after his arrest, he admitted to being part of a massive conspiracy between the police and the DEA to acquire the drugs with the dual purpose of ingesting them and selling them for profit. During the raid on his house, authorities found 300 grams of cocaine, hydrochloride, oxycodone pills, methadone, Xanax, and numerous manila envelopes filled with additional medications. All of this supposedly went unnoticed by Dominion and Newman peers. Also under fire is the leader of the drug task force, the DEA star agent Chad Scott. This is the really bad guy, who nicknamed himself the White Devil. The DEA refuses to comment on Scott's involvement, but according to the Advocate, three law enforcement sources have confirmed that he was stripped of his gun and badge and suspended from duty. This is the fourth time Scott, who has a mixed reputation as a star agent and a crooked cop, has been disciplined at the DEA, the fourth time. Yet again, the DEA is found guilty of the same crimes they lock people up for. So, you know, the biggest deal about the corruption of cops is the punishment that they don't receive, if you think about it. You know, here's this agent, Chad Scott. This is not the first time I've ran across that name. And why is he still a cop? Why isn't he in jail for doing the same thing that he's going after people for? You know, it's almost like hypocrisy should be punished more than non-hypocrisy. You know, it is, again, this is another mind-boggling part of our society, when the police can, when law enforcement can break the law the way they do and not face any criminal sanctions for it, or at least not sanctions. I mean, I gave you an example at the beginning of the show of Speaker of the House, ex-Speaker of the House, Hastert, getting 15 months for this crap that he's done. You know, and the man should be put away forever. I mean, you know, the lives that he's ruined on the basis of, you know, this child molestation, for example. You know, and here you have, I mean, the DEA, this officer, you know, who was out there arresting people, putting them in prison for a long time, you know, particularly, of course, you know, the racism involved all the time, you know, the focus on the black community the way that they do, for example. And yet he's going to be able to steal and from people and then sell drugs for profit, take drugs, and not be prosecuted the same way you and I would if the situation was the same. You know, that is another part of our society. And it's this, again, in my opinion, is our fault. Our apathy in the way that we deal with this as a society. I'm not saying you and I particularly, you know, my listeners, you know, other activists, et cetera. I mean, we're out there trying to expose this stuff all the time. I know I do it as much as possible. And I'm certainly not the only one. You know, my colleagues over at Creek Door Project are the one that brought that article to my attention, for example. But as a society, we allow this to go on, and it happens. And remember, when you talk about, like, the killing of people that the police have been doing, you know, how, for example, the city of Cleveland just gave the family of Tamir Rice $6 million, and yet they couldn't get the cops prosecuted. And this is not, and this is like the 10th one that has gone on, where, you know, Eric Gardner's family got millions and millions of dollars. Of course, those police didn't get prosecuted. We just had a police officer get prosecuted successfully for killing somebody, and then the sentence was under 2 years. I know that. I can't remember the exact. I think I might have been another 15-month sentence. Under 2 years for killing a person who was unarmed, who wasn't even in a conflict situation. It wasn't even a conflict. The officer just decided to shoot somebody walking down the stairs, basically. And that's murder, people. You know, manslaughter, murder, whatever. And they're not being held accountable because, well, you know, the pressure of the job or whatever stupid reason. And it is stupid. You know, if you're going to commit a crime, I don't care if you have a badge on yourself or not. I don't care what your history is. If you commit the crime and you're knowingly committing the crime and it's not a mistake, you need to go to prison like anybody else. And that's not what's happening in these particular instances. You know, the corruption in the Louisiana, in the New Orleans area, between what I mentioned earlier with the public defender's office refusing to take any cases, and then the story I just mentioned to you, that's That's not even all of them. There's a lot going on in the New Orleans area when it comes to corruption. They have another county where the sheriff and the second-in-command were just arrested. There were six others arrested. They're going through the cases. A bunch of cases have already been thrown out. They're going through hundreds of them. They admitted lying on the stand. They admitted making up evidence. You know, there was a group of them. And yet all these people's lives are destroyed as a result of it. And these people need to be held accountable and sent to jail, in my opinion. That's the result. Just like anybody else who commits a crime like that, you know, and to me it's even worse because these are the people that are entrusted into protecting and serving, and they take the oath, and yet they just violate it and don't care, and they get away with it. And, you know, and you have the thin blue line and all those other anecdotes. But really what we're talking about is society itself letting them get away with it. That's really what the situation here. Society has decided to be apathetic. I mean, we are apathetic as a society in all kinds of things, and you can go through the list. But these are your neighbors. These are your friends. These are your family that are being treated this way by people who are corrupt. And when it comes out, we need to hold their feet to the fire, and we need to make sure our policy leaders, our elected officials, and the replacements of the people who are corrupt, hold them accountable. You know, there's a big deal about nobody in the banking industry in this country has been put in jail for all the things that they did. It's a great example. You know, that how the Department of Justice decided Eric Holder, specifically, how they decided to go after these criminals. You know, they committed crimes. And what they did is they fined them, you know, took a bunch of money. So basically now Wall Street knows that there's not going to be any repercussions for this kind of behavior. So what would stop them from doing it again? And that's really what this amounts to. You know, when you are not punished for breaking the law because you have enough money to either defend yourself or to lobby against it or whatever. So what's to stop the behavior from continuing? There is no reason for it to stop. I mentioned earlier Debbie Word, who told a story about what happened with her daughter, and I mentioned I filmed it, and I put it into the studio this morning, and I wanted to play some of it, and hopefully we won't have any technical difficulties, but I want to offer this, and it starts out with actually an exchange with the moderator and myself talking about, you know, why defense attorneys don't do more to help clients as well, which is another problem. But Debbie's going to speak and tell you that story, and I wanted you guys to hear it. It's really, really important.
The prosecutor said if more defense counsels would walk in and say that they were going to fight, I would tell the police not to enforce on the small amounts of marijuana, and they wouldn't be in my courtroom.
Hear, hear. I mean, the truth of that is... And I'll go back to Bill. Yes, we have prosecutors who will listen, but much more than prosecutors who will listen, we have prosecutors who are afraid to work, who are afraid that they're going to have to deal with novel issues instead of the ones they're used to dealing with. But if you could put them together, it's like, listen, we're really right, this is true and honest, but if you don't do this, you're going to have 6 days of hearings with five experts, and you're going to have a whole bunch of defenses, of arrest defense, of medical necessity defense. And this is going to take you more effort than your next 56 cases. You're much more likely to get a good resolution from the prosecutor. One second, then I want to get to Jose and to Debbie Wood. Go ahead.
In Palm County, Florida, they just recently revised to a $20,000 fine at the choice of the police. So you can either be criminally prosecuted or you can be given a ticket. And the police officers will be able to decide whether it's criminal or civil. And as soon as they passed it, there were quite a few articles that were against the Jim Crow laws because everybody knew they weren't going to give the white kids down on the Madison Street anything but a ticket.
Absolutely.
And so as it came up, the sheriff finally said, we will not give anyone guns. We're arresting everybody. because I don't want
the wrong that way to go.
I agree, but he said I'm not gonna have that fall to my face. It's a race issue, so nobody's hitting the dick.
But in that conjunction, in conjunction with Billy's talk, everybody should read Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow: Mass Incarceration. And I actually think she's not exactly right about mass incarceration, because it's not just the incarceration, it's under the thumb of the criminal justice system. So even if people don't go to jail, even if they get probation or something like that, they're still on paper, they're under the thumb, they're controlled. And that
number expands to 7 million.
Pardon?
Then 2.5 million expands to 7 million.
Yeah.
Well, it's worse than that, because the system is now digitized.
Right.
And so it's now more
automatic. It's sort of, you know, it's on the balance, because I think that Julie Stewart and Sam has made a great deal of progress against the mass incarceration, against the minimum mandatories and that.
People were talking about that.
That's a large measure of tribute to Julie, who fought for 10 or 15 years when her brother got.
I think I'm going to stop that right there, because it doesn't sound like it's going to be a good audio listen to. It's kind of garbled up a little bit, and I cannot fast forward it to where she starts. I want to see what part two sounds like. Bear with me one
second. She's got it in contact. She found Jose Guzman in Columbus, Georgia.
Okay, and I found Walker. In all fairness, I found Walker, and he turned me on to Jose.
And he has been a godsend.
This is
welcome. Yes. That's really awesome. And I'm going to let him tell you the end of the story of where we are now.
Yeah, that's a little bit of a rough recording. I'm going to try and get that cleaned up so I can play it maybe next week. But essentially, that's the story I mentioned earlier, where a woman by the name of Debbie Word, her daughter, who has epilepsy, decided to continue to medicate herself and had a healthy baby as a result. And the hospital took it upon themselves to test them. And they do this to lower income and to minorities in Alabama, where, you know, they'll test. And of course, there's no probable cause. And there's, you know, the Fourth Amendment is thrown out the window. And then of course, if they find THC in the blood, they will take the child and they will charge the mother. And what brought Debbie Word around was what got her attention was that they were trying to put her daughter away for 10 years for this as well. And of course, the other side of it was is that she learned that her daughter wasn't having any more seizures and that she had a healthy granddaughter, because actually, it was her granddaughter, when they took it from her, they gave her to the grandmother, who was the person who was talking there. And, you know, obviously, one of the things where we felt that the prosecutor who accepted the non-pros was a brand-new prosecutor, younger, a millennial, certainly not stuck in any ways, and listened and agreed to the non-pros. Whereas maybe somebody who was from a different generation, with other biases, might not have done it. Who knows? The good thing is that it turned out very well for the family, and she's not being prosecuted. And, of course, she moved to Georgia out of Alabama, where, you know, cannabis is legal for certain things, of course, but you can't get it. You have to break the law to get it in any step in the right direction. But she got away from Alabama and she didn't get prosecuted. So that was very good. And a marvelous attorney named Guzman in Columbus was the one that represented her. He was also there, but again, that recording is not as good as I would hope that it was, so I could play it for you guys. So I'm going to try and get it cleaned up and so I can play it for you next week. But these things are important, you know, and of course, when that happened, when that kind of situation where you have a prosecutor who does the right thing. You know, if you recall, it happened in Oklahoma, where the Marine who was arrested and was facing all the time, and then he moved out to California and then was arrested out there, like he was a flight risk, and he was brought back to, you know, he's got to be brought back to Oklahoma, and a couple of attorneys from the movement, Sarah Swain and Matthew Pappas, were involved, and Sarah went to the Oklahoma prosecuting office and got the case dropped, you know, because, guys, he's using it for medical reasons. And he has PTSD. He's a veteran. How much of the politics do you really want to have this go against you? Because, again, it's about reputation with these people. So that was very good that they were able to do that. Anytime those things happen, it is another step in the right direction, of course. They're not happening often enough. We still have all these people in prison. But any step in that direction is very important, without a doubt. So I was happy to be at that. It was a great conference. I was there. I actually filmed Jennifer Ani in her presentation. Of course, she works in the against DFACS, against the Division of Child and Family Services. That's her wheelhouse. And she, of course, she's in a place where it's not public. You know, she's fighting a system where, you know, we can't go in and watch with her because it's not public. But she is doing very well, and, you know, she's a cannabis activist, and a lot of her cases involve, you know, cannabis, where the DFACS or the opposing parent wants to take the child away from somebody who's using medical marijuana, you know, and she's in there actually stopping it more often than not, which is great. So that was the original reason why we were there. Yeah, thank you for that, Mike, putting up a law firm in this. So I filmed her as well, and I'll also play that here in the coming weeks. I'll probably have Jennifer back on. We were just on the I'm Your Doctor 420 together in Los Angeles recently. We really enjoyed that. Of course, any time that we're able to help, you know, do it just like having Russ on is very important. So on that note, everybody, I'm gonna get out of here. I really appreciate everybody stopping by. Thank you, Russ Bellevue, for coming by, Radical Russ. He's certainly everybody. Make sure you catch his weekly podcast. He's on every single day. And check him out on High Times. I'm on the website, hightimes.com, a digital edition. He's over 400. He's written over 400 rants. I think he said it was called the Radical Rants, if I'm not mistaken. Really appreciate him stopping by. That was a great discussion, and support his great work. And, of course, everybody that's doing this stuff in Georgia, and really glad to see the torch go through the state. That is really a great idea. And, again, this is just another way to shine a light on the absurdity of prohibition. So I appreciate everybody stopping by. Thanks, Mike, for being in the chat room and keeping us up to date on things. And everybody have a great rest of the weekend. I was really happy to see that the Spurs destroyed the Thunder last night. That was. Hey, so Mike, are you happy about Luke Walton? I wanted to ask that. I know my son is. Of course, he's a Laker fan. He's happy that they got a new coach. I was wondering what your thoughts were about Luke Walton. You'll have to let me know. Everybody stay well. My Mets have won 8 in a row, so I'm really happy about that. Take care. Stay safe. And I'll see you all next week. Have a great rest of your day. We're wrong.